been developed in a very fundamental way and to a very high degree. Now, the way in which it's developed, you see, requires a protected situation. Because if we all started to act on the spur of the moment, without the slightest consideration or deliberation, if we all started to act on pure whim, everybody would think we were crazy. And people would avoid us and call the police and things like that. But what they do is this. They start you doing this in the context of a disciplined situation where there are very rigid rules for most of the time, but there are certain instances at which all those rules go hang. And you're in a community which understands the game. Because the point is this. When you start acting spontaneously, you're not used to doing it. And therefore, your responses are unintelligent and inappropriate. But when you become used to doing this, and when it becomes second nature to you to act in the state of mushin, of no mind or no deliberation, then your behavior has matured. And you find that you're accustomed to respond quite appropriately, as the Zen master did in lighting his cigarette from the charcoal. So also in learning the art of swordsmanship, when he has given up defending himself, preparing his mind for attack, then he's got a mirror mind. This is also likened to a vessel of water, like a wooden barrel. When you make a hole in the barrel, the water instantly flows out of the hole because the water is always available to come out. It doesn't have to choose. And so you could also say that mushin is what Krishnamurti calls choicelessness. And because you see, choice in this sense is not quite the same thing as decision. Choice means dithering. You know, there are some people who, before they start to write something down, they wiggle their pens a little. The pen dithers over the paper, and then they start to write. And so in the same way, a lot of people constantly in the life situation, they dither, because that dithering is anxiety. To be or not to be, that is the question. Well, there is no question about to be or not to be. See, because to be and not to be go together, as we saw, they arise mutually. So then, in the situation of the Zen community, safeguards are set up within which you can learn how to act without deliberation, which is, you see, in a sense, going back to the state of innocence. Now, it doesn't mean that you give up thinking. It doesn't mean that you become an anti-intellectual. You all can also learn, and this is part of the later phases of Zen training, how to think spontaneously, how to deliberate spontaneously. The saying is, you see, stand or walk as you will, but whatever you do, don't wobble. So this is our difficulty, because the human mind is a feedback system. Feedback has a peculiar susceptibility to nervousness. There was a young man who said, though, it seems that I know that I know. What I would like to see is the eye that knows me when I know that I know that I know. You see? Now, in this way, we think about thinking. We worry about worrying, and then when that really gets bad, you worry because you worry about worrying. Now that is analogous exactly to the kinds of vibration that are set up in certain mechanical systems. For example, if you, I did this trick on television once. I had the cameraman turn the camera on the monitor. The monitor is the television set in the studio where you see what you are doing. And so on this show I said, now I'm going to show you a picture of anxiety. Don't worry about your sets. There's not going to be anything wrong with your set, so don't turn it off. Now I said, Mr. Cameraman, will you please turn the camera on the monitor? He does that. Now what does he do? He's taking a picture of taking a picture, all in the same system. And as you do that, the system starts going like that. You see, it makes a sense up a kind of oscillation. And you see on the screen all these jagged lines dancing across. Now that's what's meant, you see, by hesitation, attachment, blocking, all that kind of thing which the Zen discipline is designed to overcome. And because the human being is such a peculiarly beautifully organized nervous system and has this tremendously subtle cortex, which is capable of all kinds of thinking about thinking, you can turn yourself on in the most extraordinary ways by, for example, getting earphones which repeat what you say just a fraction of a second after you say it back to you. They delay it. And you can get an oscilloscope tied up with your own heartbeats and get feedback through in this way so that you suddenly begin to see yourself behaving, and it completely balls you up because you wait for yourself to go on, but then you realize it's you doing it. But you can't wait on your heartbeat. You can't wait on what you say. And you get this sensation of going faster and faster and faster and faster until you just have to close the whole thing off. You'll go crazy. So that's what we're doing. And our civilization and our social institutions reflect this in hundreds of ways. And this would be true of any civilization, because all civilization is based on the development of consciousness and feedback, that is to say, the property of self-control, of being self-conscious, looking at what you've done, and then being able to criticize it and correct it. But who criticizes? Is the critic reliable? When you criticize yourself, who will criticize the critic? You see? Or to put it in the other way, quis custodiet ipsos custodies? Who will guard the guards themselves? Who will take care of the policeman? Who will govern the president? And that is the big problem. And when we get tied up in that problem, the Chinese got tied up in it because they were simply a very high order of civilization. So did the Japanese. There has to be a break. Somebody has to start throwing things. Otherwise, everybody will go insane. So, Zen functions in that culture as a way of liberation from the tangle of being too civilized. Now you see, in Japanese culture, people are tremendously concerned with propriety, with good manners, and with keeping up with the Joneses. One of the funniest things in the world is to watch Japanese people having a bowing contest. It's a very frequent thing when friends meet or take leave. They go, and they bow and they bow and they respond, and it goes back and forth, and see who gets the last one in because I'm more polite than you. And the worries about when somebody comes, you know, you visit a family, you always bring a gift. And they start worrying, is this gift suitable? Is it anything as good as the gift they last gave us? And is it right for the occasion? Have we thought about it enough? Is there some symbolism in this gift that connects with this person's name or their birthday or something like that? And they think about these things interminably. And thus they cultivate in the ordinary culture has a great deal of social nervousness in it. People giggle. You often see girls who giggle and cover their mouths to say, I'm not really giggling. All sorts of funny things happen because of this immense social awareness and nervousness. Now, Zen breaks that up. only it does it in a way that is has high artistry to it. So you see, in let's just take the aesthetic domain for the moment. In the whole history of ceramics, the Chinese developed some of the most elegant work imaginable. You are probably aware, I don't see a specimen, of the great work of the Sung and Korean potters, very often done in a jade-like green, the most gorgeous texture. It looked practically as if it was carved out of jade. Well, that led on, you see, to the high techniques of the Ming Dynasty with translucent porcelain, white clay, the most subtle designs of all. And that style went also to Japan. And the very, very rich people you read about in, say, books like The Tale of Genji, and you see in a film, and you must see it, Chushingura, the story of the 47 Ronin. The lovely things they had around their houses were unbelievable. The lacquer, the boxes in pure gold, and, you know, it was delicious stuff. But then, it was just like having too much eclairs and ice cream and filet mignon and cooked à la carême, you know, that French cook who made everything look like an oriental palace. And now what happened? The people who practiced Zen suddenly got an eye for the beauty of the ordinary. There were two reasons for this. One was that they became fascinated with what happened spontaneously, what pattern a brush would make when handled roughly and the hairlines were shown. They also, because they practiced Zazen, which is sitting quietly, not thinking of anything special, but having a completely open mind, that puts you into a state where you get much better eyes and ears than you ordinarily have. And you start really seeing things. So you know that famous haiku poem, "The old pond, a frog jumps in, plop." In Japanese, that plop is mizu no oto, sound of the water. And there's another poem just like it, "In the dark forest, a berry drops, the sound of the water." Somebody suddenly realized, you see, just the sound of the water is marvelous. That's all. They found that they kept getting in very, very cheap Korean rice bowls, the poorest, cheapest kind for peasants to eat out of. And suddenly it struck one of these Zen masters that that was an incomparably beautiful object. Nobody had seen this before. They also had the simplest wooden ladles, bamboo, and then a stick in it for use in the kitchen. And one day somebody noticed that this ordinary, everyday kitchen utensil was just lovely. And so in the same way, they found that it was quite as satisfactory to listen to the kettle boiling as to listen to an elaborate concert. So what did they do? They started, through particularly a man called Senno Rikyu, to give parties for very small, few guests in shacks, little huts in the garden, made of very primitive materials, such as mud walls, and where they would go and sit, and out of the simplest utensils, carefully chosen by a superb artist. They would simply sit and enjoy the uncomplicated life. And so was born the tea ceremony. Now look at that, you see, in the historical context, that's terribly important. It was a going back to the primitive after people were sick of too much civilization. And yet, it was going on to the primitive rather than back. Because the people who selected all those things, they knew the whole tradition of their civilization, their culture. They weren't barbarians. This became the rage. Rikyu became attached to the court. The shogun had tea with Rikyu. And everybody started digging tea ceremony. And in due course, the whole thing became awful. Because what's happened today is this. Tea ceremony is essentially something to enjoy. And there are a few men left who know how to serve tea ceremony. And it's an extremely congenial, quiet get-together. Of easy conversation, simple and unostentatious manners, and really lovely things to look at. I was present at a tea ceremony celebrated by a Zen monk who happens to be an American. And he is a man who has done a lot of mountaineering. And he has, therefore, with him at all times, the sort of equipment that you take on camping in the mountains, because he does a lot of climbing in Japan. And I said to him, won't you, this afternoon would be very nice to have the tea ceremony, and you did it once before here, and it was so pleasant. Would you serve it again? He said, yes, by all means. Before, he had served tea ceremony in the style that Zen monks do it, which is rather simple and direct and much more comfortable than all these well-educated ladies who are on tittering about it and are on tiptoe and nervous and hoping they won't make a mistake and all that kind of thing. It's just dreadful. So he suddenly came in with a small Primus stove, set that down. Then he had an old paint pot, which had inside it an aluminum mug. He set that down. He then proceeded to take the aluminum mug out, pour water into the paint pot, and set that on the Primus stove, but he ritually pumped up the Primus stove. He did everything in the style of tea ceremony, but this was a dirty old Primus stove. And suddenly the thing began to flame like the god Fudo. And he mixed the tea in the traditional way with the whisk, had all the perfect and lovely manners, handing us the aluminum cup. And we got into a long, it's the custom after the tea ceremony, after you've drunk, to pass all the utensils round for inspection. And this is exactly what happened. And we found that the aluminum cup had the year 1945 stamped on it for some reason. We got into a discussion about styles of aluminum cups made in 1945. And it was the funniest thing, but it was a complete makeover of the tea ceremony into the modern idiom. Of course, the tea drunk in tea ceremony is that powdered green tea, which you don't steep like you make ordinary tea. You whisk it, and mixed with a small amount of hot water, into a froth. And it's called liquid jade. And it's a bit of an acquired taste for most Westerners. It tastes a little bit like a mixture of mate tea and Guinness. But when you get to know it, it's very invigorating and very awakening. And if you make up a strong mixture of it, it's a good thing to use if you want to stay awake all night and do work. And so you see, it's the legend was that Zen monks started this interest in tea because they needed it to stay awake during their practice of meditation. And it said that Bodhidharma is always drawn with eyes that are wide open. Why? Because he hasn't got any eyelids. Once when he was meditating, he fell asleep. And he was furious and cut his eyelids off. And as they dropped on the ground, up came the first tea plants. That's why they have leaves shaped like eyelids and are all...